I'd like to acknowledge the owners of this country, not the traditional owners, I'll explain that later, and the ancestors. I'd also like, while I'm here, to acknowledge my ancestors and my owners in my country. My father's Gugatha, South Australia, and my mother's Thurlington down the south coast of New South Wales. Anybody who knows me knows that I'm the white sheep in the family. I suppose getting to the tin tacks of native title. What people need to know about native title is it's nothing but a fraud. The easiest way to describe what native title is: native title is a knee-jerk reaction to Resolution 262525 of the 24th of October 1970, where the UN passed a resolution that Australia assented to. It stated two very important things. One was that the tribes could assimilate into the current UN member state, in this case called Australia, or we had the opportunity to establish our own separate sovereign states. And if we did that, in the exercise of our right to self-determination and and our right to self-determination and equal rights, if we exercise that right, the Crown, in this case, is not allowed to subject us to alien subjugation. In other words, they're not allowed to subject us to the laws and the penalties of the laws of a foreign power, namely the Crown or the UK Parliament, or any of the Australian Parliaments. The Australian Parliaments, we must remember, are nothing but corporations owned by the Crown Corporation from the City of London. Okay? They have no authority over a person, over a human being whatsoever. They can only deal in what is called a person. And if you want to know what a person is, your birth certificate is your person. You are not your person. Okay? You are the man, woman, or the child. The person is the corporate identity that has the name that you believe is attached to you. The resolution from 1970 stumped the Australian Parliament because it realised it had to deal with either the establishment of a bunch of separate sovereign states within the boundaries of the continent, or they had to find some legal way, not lawful, but legal way, to bring the tribes under the subjection of the Crown. I'll just go back a bit. We've researched this argument now for about 18 years. We have some eminent legal minds that are now assisting us. We've actually been able to call on a number of the ex-members of the House of Lords who have now realised that what their parliament did to us, or tried to do to us, has now been done to them in 1999 when Tony Blair amended the House of Lords Act, which was an act of criminal high treason. He removed the bloodline-connected elders of country from England from their parliaments or their elders' councils. The hereditary lords in England are the bloodline-connected elders of country for that land. And by altering the Act, the House of Lords Act in 1999, Tony Blair introduced elected peers. And he also changed a very long history in England, but the best part about that is we now have the support of the bloodline-connected hereditary lords in setting the record straight both there and here. And the one thing we're able to do was to impress upon them, everywhere that the Crown has done this to the tribes across the planet, those tribes will stand up and help the hereditary lords of England, so long as the hereditary lords of England stand up and assist us and back us in our cause for documents such as a writ of mandamus against the UK Parliament and Australian Parliaments in respect of the use of British statutes against us. We've researched the argument back. The argument really, in a legal context, doesn't need to go back any further than the 8th of June 1383. But we've actually researched the argument all the way back to 450 BC to the Molyneux Laws of England, and we can prove that there is not one shred of evidence that supports any claim by any non-tribal person to any portion of lands in this country. Some of the things we discovered along the way, I was fortunate enough to meet an old surveyor from Tasmania. He was 96 when I spoke to him, and he remembers about how they were told to draw up the plans for the Department of Planning and Department of Lands. And when Australians buy a thing called a lot in a DP, what they are buying is a thing called the location of title for the lot in a deposited plan. Now, that's just for the sake of the argument. Let's say that that pillar there is the plan that's held in the Department of Lands. And the little switch on the back there, that switch is the lot. When you buy a lot in a DP, you are buying that little mark on the map. And that's why Australians are called land holders and not land owners. Because the Crown has never been able to vest an interest in land that the Crown itself has never taken lawfully. Now, after 1970, there were two orders in council. An order in council is a law made by the monarch of the Parliament of the United Kingdom, which can only be repealed or amended by that monarch. If that monarch passes away, before that law is amended or repealed, it stands for all time. There was an order in council created in 1844 where Queen Victoria told the Parliament, and by law, that the Aboriginal people were not allowed to even sell land to the settlers if the alienation of that land was going to cause discomfort to the tribal people in the way of either prohibiting them from exercising their rights over their lands or conducting ceremony or observing their previous practices. 1836, on the 19th of February, King William IV issued letters patent for the state of South, or province of South Australia, for example. And those letters patent, which gave a right to certain settlers to settle in a particular way on a particular portion of this continent, had a caveat over them. And those letters patent, by ordering council, stated that they were not to interfere with the tribal people's right to their land or their enjoyment in that land in the characters of themselves or their descendants, and it was open-ended. So Australia, South Australia, was not even allowed to be occupied beyond what the tribes themselves would give or allow to be occupied. When we sat with Rear Admiral Kevin Scarce, who was the Governor of South Australia at the time, I think from memory it was about 2007, February 2007, we pointed this out to him. He was fairly shocked, and he came out on Living Black, I believe it was, and made a statement very clearly that the state of South Australia must revisit the letters patent and start to comply with them. What happened in 1872 was there was an act created called the Pacific Island Protection Act. Now, there are a number of academics who are saying that this act doesn't apply in Australia. I don't have the time in 10 minutes to go into the argument as to why it does, but I will simply say that in the amendment to the Criminal Code in 1999, there was an amendment made, and in the amendment there was an insertion made into the schedule of the Act. The amendment in the schedule to the Act, or the schedule in the amendment, stated very clearly that the government at that point in time, the Australian Parliament, repealed the Pacific Island Protection Acts of 1872 and 1875. Two very important problems with that. Nothing in the schedule to an act has any lawful effect because it's not part of the body of the act, so therefore it's not part of law. But there would be no grounds or need for the Australian Parliament to repeal those acts if they weren't applicable within the Australian territories. But that's just a simple way of dismissing the argument that the Pacific Island Protection Acts don't apply. There is a more detailed argument, but don't have time. In 1872, the Pacific Island Protection Act was created. In 1875, Queen Victoria made another order in council. That order in council contained two very special sections. Section 6, which specifically barred the use of the Crown's jurisdiction against tribal peoples, and it specifically limited the exercise of that jurisdiction to British subjects only, and the tribal people have never been British subjects. Again, there is an argument that Aboriginal people, by becoming Australian citizens, become British subjects. But the fact is that by becoming British subjects, when the government fails to inform us that by becoming Australian citizens we are becoming British subjects and we lose our tribal rights, or supposedly lose our tribal rights, that is an act of extrinsic fraud, and nothing lawful can be gained by an act of fraud. But that's a very detailed argument, but that's the simple aspect of the argument. The second part of that amendment that was vitally important was Section 7. And Section 7 says, under the title of Rights of the Tribes, that the Crown was not allowed to extend or construe to extend sovereignty or dominion into the islands and other places. The other places, the Pacific Islands being the islands, the other places being the Australasian colonies. There are a set of rules called Halsbury's Rules. These change over a period of time, but the contemporaneous version in relation to the amendment to the Pacific Island Protection Act is Edition 3. If you go to page 337, paragraph 559, part 12 and 12.1, it states that the Parliament of the United Kingdom was not allowed to usurp the sovereignty of the tribes, and the tribes are not allowed to usurp the sovereignty of the Parliament of the United Kingdom. That was why, when Burnham put the flag in the cliffs of Dover, the British laughed, because they knew that he was not able to usurp their sovereignty, and they were not able to usurp ours. And it also states in that section of Halsbury's that every Parliament is sovereign in its own right, and a subsequent Parliament cannot derogate or take away from the legislation of a previous Parliament. Now, when Queen Victoria gave royal assent to an act of the British Parliament called 63 and 64, Victoria Chapter 12, an act to constitute the Commonwealth of Australia, Section 9 of which is called the Constitution of Australia, that constitution contained two very important sections, Section 51.26 and Section 127. 51.26 said they could not make laws for people of the Aboriginal race. The reason they could not was because they had to comply with Section 6 of the Ordering Council of the 2nd of August 1875. They could not make laws for us, they could not exercise their jurisdiction over us. Section 127, which said they could not count us as part of their population, was put in there because they had to comply with Section 7 of the Pacific Island Protection Act, which said they could not extend their sovereignty over us or our lands. And they couldn't count us as part of their population because we're a separate sovereign races or tribes of peoples. In 1967, there was a monumental fraud pulled over this continent. We must remember that any law that's given royal assent by a monarch of the Parliament of the United Kingdom applies to British subjects only. Bear in mind the tribes are not British subjects, and were not British subjects at the time of the referendum in 1967, because we hadn't been given citizenship rights. Now, what happened was that the Federal Parliament asked a question of the Australian citizens. The question was, do you want to repeal Section 51, or amend 51.26 and repeal 127? The answer was in the affirmative in all states and territories. So they amended 51.26 and repealed 127. The problem with that was that the only people involved in that were the British subjects, and they were only talking about a law that affected them. The one thing that they failed to do, which was a monumental oversight on behalf of the Crown, was they failed to ask the tribes, did the tribes acquiesce their sovereignty? Okay? Now, by failing to ask that question and getting a decree, if you want, from the tribal peoples that we want to acquiesce our sovereignty, we retain our sovereignty. 1970, the UN resolution that says that we have the right to establish our own separate sovereign states. So from 1970, when that resolution was created, until 1993, the government had to work feverishly behind the scenes. They created a bunch of statutes, they amended a bunch of laws, and in 1993, they came up with a thing called native title. Now, let's look at native title. Anyone who's been to a native title meeting would know that the first thing you do when you walk in the room, you get told that native title is subject to all other title rights. The reason it is subject to all other title rights is because native comes from the Latin word nativus. And by the way, I know people have issues with the way I use words, but in the street, I'll use common English. When I'm in a court of law, I'll use the legal terms. Now, through the fraudulent conveyance of language, they've taught us to use words that mean the wrong thing. In the street, the word native means tribal or Aboriginal, which itself is an offensive term. In court, the term native comes from the Latin nativus, which means someone born into slavery or servitude. So native title is slave's title. And if you want to question whether they're talking about a slave, everyone knows that a slave cannot hold land, cannot own land, correct? The reason that there is a thing called a prescribed body corporate put in place is because slaves can't hold land. And the land is invested with the tribes or the natives. It's vested with the prescribed body corporate. The prescribed body corporates are corporations that are registered to the Crown, and they are registered to the Crown through the Registrar of Indigenous Corporations, who, when they're good and ready, sometime up the track after the native title scam goes through, they will appoint an administrator to the PBC and they will sell the assets, including the land. Pardon me. And then the land laundering is complete. 100 years from now, none of the tribal people left on this continent were going to ever know that they had been robbed of their sovereignty through a fraud. In order to make a native title claim, you have to admit that you are a traditional owner. Again, in the street, the term traditional means customary or from old time. In legal terms, in the court, the term traditional comes from the Latin traditio, which means someone who has sold their land to someone else. Hence the term, everyone's heard the term they use called trade and commerce. Why do they use the term trade and commerce if they mean the same thing? Well, they don't. The term commerce relates to the use of money to buy and sell. The term trade refers to land, the trading in land, traditio. Okay? The very first form of transferring of title to land was called traditio in Latin. That's where the word comes from, and that's what it means at law. So if you're a traditional owner, first of all, you sign on as a traditional owner, you're signing on that you've sold the land to someone else. If you're asking the Crown for some of that land back, obviously you must have either sold it to the Crown or sold it to someone else who sold it to the Crown, because you're asking the Crown for some of that land. Now, I sort of used to mix in particular circles where I was taught a lot of things about the law and governance. Because I had white skin, I was able to get in and out of places and then get close to people who wouldn't have otherwise spoken to me if I'd have had dark skin. But the fact remains that they taught me what I know, and pardon the French, but they are pissed that I'm telling everyone. When it comes down to the facts of native title, anyone who signs on to native title is giving their land to the Crown by way of a fraud. Nothing comes from native title. Ask the Mirra people who are about to lose their native title. I believe if you look at the Dungutty mob as well, down mid-north coast of New South Wales, they've had an administrator appointed to their PBC. Okay, so, and I think it was about 95 or 96 they got their determination through. we can have a look at the Githubul, for example. We've been talking about this the last few days. The Githubul had their native title determination made in 2007. I'm sorry, yeah, 2007? Yeah, 17th of August 2007. Since that time, the Crown has not transferred any lands to the PBC. Not one portion of the land that was to be transferred has been transferred. We gave them notices that the Githubul accepted the abandonment of native title. When those notices were delivered, they failed to respond because they couldn't respond to the terms of the notices. And now what they've done is they're trying to force the reinvigoration of the PBC so they can force the issue of native title. Pardon me. The issue with native title isn't so much that we shouldn't go down the road of native title. The issue of native title is that we don't need to. All we need to do is give notice to the Crown in a proper form that we are here. If I'm a bit of an analogy, the Crown's been looking around to see where the tribal sovereigns are, but they can't see it because the tribal sovereigns are not standing up and saying, listen, on the 31st of December this year, your rent-free period ceases. From that day on, you pay rent. Right? The sovereign tribes aren't standing up and making themselves visible to the Crown, so the Crown is exercising a jurisdiction and a right that it has assumed, or in the terms of a letter that we got from the Lands Minister in New South Wales, they are working on the presumption that there is no sovereign tribe. Okay? Because there is no one standing up saying, we are a sovereign tribe. Okay? So far as what can happen in respect of native title and standing up against native title, it's my understanding from most of the tribes that I speak to, every tribe is different. There's patriarchal, and there's different ways that they apply their law and exercise their law. But most tribes, when dealing with issues of land, require the whole consensus, the full consensus of the tribe to deal with that land. A prescribed body corporate is not made up of all of the people who have an interest, a tribal interest in land. It's generally a select few, and I don't mean a select as in a particular few, but it's not always the whole tribe. And the whole tribe has a right to say in relation to that portion of law in relation to land. I know both my parents, under tribal law, that's the case, particularly with the Gugatha. Now, there are people who are making agreements with the Crown as small groups in relation to native title, but they do not generally represent the whole of the tribe. There's so much that I'm trying to condense this into 10 minutes, and my brain's racing on. It's a bit hard to sort of get out what I've got in here in 10 minutes. The fact is that native title is a fraud. The Crown knows that it holds no sovereignty over the land. The only way that they can get hold of the sovereignty over the land is if, by means of cajoling the tribes or conning the tribes into agreeing, through the terms used in the native title process, that the Crown owns the land and has a right to give some of that land back to the tribes under a particular form of title. Our problem is that we don't read things. How many people have read the native title application form? And how many people have actually looked at section Q or part Q of the native title application form? You'll notice that it says that you must sign that the Crown owns all mineral and petroleum and other rights in the land. Now, why do we need to sign off on that if the Crown owns it? Wouldn't that be a self-evident fact? Why do we need to give consent to a consent determination before the federal court? It's because we own the land, and we must consent to the divestment of that land under their law. They know they can't take the land. And in order for native title to be legitimate, there has to be consent for the transfer of title. We must give that consent. If we withhold that consent, there's nothing they can do. They'll jump up and down, they'll be bluff and bluster, and they'll carry on like a pack of pansies, but the bottom line is, they can't do anything. And any mobs that have sort of sat back and held off and held off and held off on native title, you'll notice how frustrated the solicitors get. All right? They're not getting frustrated for any other reason. Then they've got an agenda. We were up in Mareeba about 3 months ago, and we went to a meeting at Atherton where the North Queensland Land Council had one of its solicitors attending this meeting. When we walked in and started asking the solicitor some questions, like we asked her, can you please explain a few of the terms that are related to native title that we would like to know? We asked her about traditional, we asked her about native. What she did was she got up, she smashed down the lid on the laptop computer and started abusing the elders. She was a Maori woman, started abusing the elders in Maori because they weren't doing as they were told. They weren't signing off on native title. Okay? Another thing you might find interesting is if you go through the Native Title Act, you'll find at part 5, it lists a definition of all the words that need to be defined in the Act. The only two words that are not defined are native and traditional. The reason they are not defined is so that the Crown can manipulate those terms. They can imply to the tribes during the negotiations that traditional and native mean one thing, but then apply a different meaning in law if there's an argument. Okay? Why didn't you know it's native title? It's a legal process. Did you think we were using common English? That'll be the question. What we've got to remember is that when we deal with the Crown, we're not dealing with honourable people. Okay, you show me an honourable politician, I'll show you a dead one. Okay, it's as simple as that. The fact is that these people know what they are doing. The solicitors, if they don't know these terms and they don't know what they're talking about, they're negligent and they shouldn't be practising. But the Crown won't take action against them because the Crown is benefiting from the fraud and the negligence being conducted by those solicitors and barristers. Have a look at native title. Does everyone know what the term unconscionable means? Right, there's a few people that don't. The term unconscionable at law means effectively something that a man of a fair conscience wouldn't do, or a woman of a fair conscience would not do. It's unconscionable. Now, unconscionable is using improper means to do something. Now, I'll ask you a question. Consider native title. There are two interested parties. There's the tribe and there's the crown. We have the tribe over here. We have the crown over here. We have the crown's courts, the crown's laws, the crown's barristers, the crown's solicitors, all of the crown's legal resources. The crown then gives a couple of bodgy solicitors to a tribe and says, these people are going to help you, yet these people have an allegiance to the crown. That is unconscionable. Okay? It is unconscionable for the crown to even be a party to the negotiations. There's an interesting problem that the federal court faces. All of the magistrates who sit in the federal court have what's called financial joinder to the crown. So when you're standing in court, there's the crown solicitors over here representing the crown, their crown barristers. There's solicitors and barristers on this side that are representing the tribe who have sworn into the crown's law society, etc., their bar association. And there's usually a bloke dressed in a frock, oddly enough, sitting up on the bench. And he gets paid by the same people paying them and the same people paying your barristers and solicitors. That to me is a bit odd. But that's the process they use. And why do they use that process? First of all, you're just a black fella. You don't understand what we're talking about, number one. So what you need is you need a barrister and you need a solicitor. And you need them to mediate between these barristers and these solicitors over here. And when these two go their separate ways, they'll go and sit down and have a cup of tea and discuss what's going on. And the only people who get jammed out of it is the tribe. Ask a native title solicitor or barrister, if anyone's going through native title at the moment, ask your solicitor or your barrister, why aren't the terms native and traditional defined in the Act? Ask them, do they know what the legal terms are, what the legal meanings of those terms are. Okay? And let's get something else too. When we talk about legal, we're not talking lawful. Lawful is according to law. By law, I mean the law of the land. Okay? When we talk about legal, we're talking about legislative provisions, legislation, acts of parliament, which are not law. Because an act is a statute, and a statute is the bylaw of a corporation. And the reason they're called statutes is because the Crown Corporation owns those statutes. They're the bylaw of one of the Crown Corporation subsidiaries. Okay? And a lot of people don't know that the Crown isn't the thing that the Queen wears. When you see a police officer and he's got the crown on his arm, that crown is the emblem for the Crown Corporation. It's a corporation based in a place called the City of London, which is a square mile in London City. The Queen can't go in that square mile without consent from the City of London. In the City of London is where all the banks are, and all the monetary concerns of the planet are basically administered from that square mile in London. Now, the Crown Corporation subsidiaries, like, for example, the United Kingdom Parliament and the Australian Parliaments, they have an obligation to the Crown. They're not interested in seeing... they have no interest, the Crown has no interest in seeing the tribes come out with a benefit. The Crown wants to see the Crown win. That's why they've... That's why they've done things the way they've done. Excuse me for a second. What we need to do, and the reason that the Crown, by the way, has made sure that we were jammed into missions and we weren't educated, was because they only needed to teach us one thing, and that was the English language, common English. Because by teaching us the English language, we can then consent to what they are doing, because we understand what they are saying. If that makes sense. We only need to understand their language to say, yes, we'll go through native title. Yes, we'll sign off. It's even like the word understand is an interesting word. In common English, the word understand means to comprehend. In court, the term understand means to stand under or admit to. That's why you get asked two questions. When you walk into court, you get asked two straight questions. Do you understand the charges?